This is a recording of the public hearing on hybrid communications held by the Federal Election Commission on July 11, 2007. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Notice of proposed rulemaking in the Federal Register on May 10, 2007. And sought and received comments on a proposed rule that would define when and how a political party could attribute the cost of a public communication that refers to a clearly identified federal candidate and that also generically refers to other candidates of a political party without clearly identifying them. I'd like to thank the Office of the General Counsel staff for their hard work in the preparation of this proceeding and the rule itself, and especially would like to thank Rosie Smith and Amy Rothstein, as well as Asa Asfar and Bob Knott. I'd also like to thank all of the people who took the time and the effort to comment on the proposed rules, in particular for those who have agreed to appear as witnesses today and bring to us both their practical experience and their expertise on the issues raised in the rulemaking. Briefly, this is the format that we will follow today. We expect to have a total of 7 witnesses who will be divided into 2 panels. Each panel will last an hour and a half, and we'll have a short break between the 2 panels. Each witness has 5 minutes to make an opening statement. We have a light system at the witness table to help you keep track of time. The green light will start to flash when you have 1 minute left. The yellow light will go on when you have 30 seconds left, and the red light means that it's time to wrap up your remarks. I've been given a small box here to monitor that, which is called the Shockatron here at the FEC. So please try and comply with those rules. The balance of time for the panels is reserved for questions by the commissioners and answers by the witnesses. For each panel, we will begin with questions from the commissioners. Commissioners that have a question will seek recognition from the chair. We will not use the lighting system to time the questions or the answers during that time. We trust that all involved will be concise, and I will provide guidance or insight if I am concerned that too much time is being taken by any particular witness at today's hearing. In preparation for today's hearing, I did something a little procedurally out of the order or ordinary as a consequence of my experiences in last year's hearing, which is that I put out on the public record the questions that I thought I would be asking the witnesses to provide them with some time to think about those questions. Stephen Horsting of the I'm going to blank on the name of his group now, unfortunately. The Center for Competitive Politics was kind enough to provide written responses on the Internet last night, and I appreciate that. Unfortunately, our staff has raised the nettlesome question of whether we can accept those given that the comment period is closed. And so the commission has decided to reopen the comment period for an additional week to resolve any kind of outstanding procedural questions, and certainly Mr. Horsting's comments will be accepted during that time period, and anybody else who would like to make additional comments is free to over the next 7 days. With that, I understand that some of my colleagues and certainly the Vice Chairman would like to make opening statements, and so I now turn the microphone over to him. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize. I'm going to bore my colleagues and the Commission staff by repeating something I had said in an earlier stage in the rulemaking, and one is already covering phrase, but there's a specific reason I'm doing this, and this is the point at which we are building a record that some future judge may look at and say, why did the commission do this? And there is a point important to me that I want to make about the history of political party activity, for which I begin in Sapphire's Political Dictionary with a curious entry called Jaime's Ferry Boat, attributed to Jaime Shorenstein, the Brooklyn Democratic leader, who was challenged in the 1920s when FDR was governor of New York by a local candidate who wanted to know why all the party's money was being spent on Roosevelt signs, making the point that everybody already knew Roosevelt and the party needed to do something to increase the candidate's name ID. Rather than answering directly, Jaime asked, "Did you ever watch the ferries come in from Staten Island?" The candidate allowed us how he had and waited for Jaime's point. "When that big ferry from Staten Island sails into the ferry slip, it never comes in strictly alone. It drags in all the crap from the harbor behind it." Imey let the message sink in before adding, FDR is our Staten Island ferry. Now, Sapphire goes on to indicate that after he first published this story, he was contacted by several people who attributed it back to Jimmy Walker, one-time mayor of New York, back further to Nicholas Murray Butler, president of Columbia University, who himself said he had heard the story from Boysie Penrose, a leader of the Pennsylvania delegation in the Republican Convention of 1912, had heard a similar story. He then cross-references the section on coattails, which includes a speech by a then-backbench congressman named Abraham Lincoln in 1848, who talked about the coattails of Zachary Taylor and on back to those of Andrew Jackson. My point is that the coattail effect of party leaders upon down-ticket candidates has been present in American politics since the founding of modern political parties in the Jacksonian era. And it's important to me because all of this discussion and virtually all of the comments that we've received have been focused on this in the context of BCRA and even more narrowly in the context of the all hard money post-BCRA world, or I meant to say first in post-FICA, 1974-76. And when we debate this question about are the parties doing something that is trying to get around FICA or get around BCRA or abuse it, it's important to me to look back at the past and say, well, what did the parties do before these limits existed? And in fact, there is strong incontrovertible evidence that parties, in fact, formed their campaigns around the ticket leaders from the beginning of the party system. And that perspective is critical to me in judging what's going on or what's reasonable in terms of thinking about how parties conduct their activity and, consequently, what expenses we allow a party to attribute to the party as opposed to particular candidates. I thank my colleagues for their apologize for them having to listen to this a second time, but it's a point that I want on the record at a point when we're making the record third time.
Certainly. Thank you, and I'm sure we all appreciate it. It is never boring to hear you, and the story was actually better in the second telling than the first. Are there any other opening statements from any of the other commissioners? Okay, very good. We will then move to our first panel, who may advance. Our first panel this morning consists of Stephen M. Horsting, who is here on behalf of the Center for Competitive Politics, Thomas J. Josifiak, former chairman of this agency and currently appearing on behalf of the Republican National Committee, and Neil Reif, who is appearing on behalf of the Democratic National Committee. We generally proceed alphabetically, which means that unless you gentlemen have arranged otherwise, we will begin with Mr. Horsting and then would go to Mr. Josifiak and Mr. Reif. Seeing no indication that you've agreed otherwise, Mr. Horsting, please proceed, and I will try and see if I can make this machinery work properly.
Thank you, Chairman Lenhard, Vice Chairman Mason, Commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on the hybrid ad rulemaking. And I appreciate you putting my supplemental comments into the record. And frankly, the reason I wrote them last night, honestly, was to give time for Tom and Neil, Joe's not here, to really answer most of your questions this afternoon. Because let's be honest, they have real candidates in the 2008 cycle that will really be impinged or benefited by what you do here today. Let me note at the outset that I've noticed some discussion in the comments and perhaps some disagreement or confusion about time and space allocations versus number of participant allocations. And I'd like to suggest here that there's not really any conflict there, that the commission should consider using both allocation methods if it's going to craft a rule that addresses all public communications. Depending on certain media, time and space may make sense, whereas number of participants could make sense in another medium. The biggest concern for CCP in this rulemaking is the way the commission will flesh out its test, benefit reasonably to be derived. The test is not benefit actually derived, it's benefit reasonably to be derived. The commission is supposed to employ objective criteria to protect the in-kind contribution limits, provide notice to the party committees in allocating their activity, and allow them freedom under the First Amendment to use phrases and monikers that they believe will best suit their purposes, if at all possible. So it's the point of the FEC to look at an ad, at its text, to find some evidence of an objective placeholder for the party committee, and then decide, well, how much of that ad can fairly be attributed to the party committee? What's its value? What the commission should not be doing is employing subjective criteria, either empirical data, anecdotal evidence, or social research data to look at the relative benefit of a phrase such as liberals in Congress versus Democrats in Congress. For the commission to regulate in this way is to engage in a content-based regulation. Now, we have express advocacy test and electioneering communication tests, which are content-based regulations in FECA and BCRA, but those are to cure against vagueness and overbreadth and to protect speakers, not as bases for the commission to probe relative value of monikers or phrases. Now, the reformers say that the value of a public communication identifying a federal candidate inures entirely to the identified candidate, regardless of whether a generic party reference is included in the communication. We would disagree with this. And the commission may want some assurance that down ticket benefits are real, just as Vice Chairman mentioned, and as the Vice Chairman brought it up, I'm not sure I can improve upon it, but I would leave with the reformers one example that I believe rebuts their case, and it's the 2004 senatorial race in Alaska between Governor Knowles and Lisa Murkowski. For months, Knowles led Murkowski by significant margins, and the NRSC's advertising was not helping Senator Murkowski. Finally, the Republican Party decided to cut a new ad with a new approach. The NRSC decided to tie the Murkowski race to the fate of Alaska Senator Ted Stevens, just as the Republican Party tied the fate of, quote, leaders in Congress to President Bush in 2004. Murkowski came from behind to defeat Knowles. Though she was scarcely mentioned in the ad, she enjoyed all the benefits of being tied to Stevens, and the NRSC knew that. Now, the reformers may reply, listen, Stevens wasn't even a candidate in 2004, so your analogy breaks down. But this is really something for the commission to consider. If Stevens was not a candidate, there was no way the NRSC could have benefited him by touting him or mentioning him, yet they chose to do so. Why? Because they knew that tying Murkowski to that other person or being associated with that other person created a benefit for Murkowski. Otherwise, the NRSC would have wasted its money. But we know the NRSC did not waste its money, just as we know that down-ticket benefits from generic references are real. Thank you.
Thank you. Can't remember who I said was going to be next. I guess Mr. Josefiak is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. Good morning, commissioners. There are three individuals here today that have signed on to the comments that we have prepared, so I'm not going to be redundant and try to quote from the comments. But I thought perhaps this morning I could be helpful to you in trying to give you my perspective of on just very briefly on a number of issues. First would be, should there continue to be hybrid ads? And the answer in my mind is yes. I don't think you need a regulation or a sanction in a regulation to have hybrid ads. But personally, I'm not opposed to having a regulation that spells out what the commission's position is, particularly outside of Washington, D.C. I mean, I am perfectly comfortable with what the commission has done in the past, and I'm going to discuss that a little bit as far as why I think the regulations and the law on their face allow for it, and that there should not be very much subjectivity promoted by the commission in trying to draft a regulation, so that regulation needs to be very simplistic and just reinforce what actually I think is already in the law and current regulations and current practice of this commission. Allocation by parties. Commissioner Mason has talked about the beginning of modern political parties. I've been accused of being around since then, but I'm not going to talk about going back that far. I want to talk about in the FEC BCRA era of what parties have done. From the very beginning of this commission, with regard to party allocations, the commission acknowledged in its own regulations the ability of party committees to allocate in the generic sense on a reasonable basis. Then based upon negotiations between groups and the courts, the commission then came up with a percentage. Based on, for state parties, it was based on a number of candidates on the ballot, federal versus non-federal, and how you would split those costs. For the national party committees, it was a fixed percentage. Over the years as well, the commission adopted policies and procedures to deal with what happens when candidates and party committees do things together. They did polls together. They shared phone calls together. They shared space together. In every one of those cases, the commission took the position that you paid for whatever your share was based on the time and space devoted to your operation. I think the most graphic example of the commission's position was the commission's discussion and debate, not only at the commission level, but also at the staff level in the 2000 Bush audit. In that audit, the question wasn't whether or not you could allocate. The question was what the percentage was. The campaign took the position at the time it was based on time and space, based on this, the history of this commission, and based on the position of commissioners up until that time. The audit staff and the general counsel staff took a position that in those kinds of situations it should be 50% based on very different theories. But the bottom line, and what I want to emphasize, it was never a question of whether it could be done. It was what the percentage was. And then based on that, we enter the era of this commission, for most of you commissioners at least, where you had your regulation dealing with phone banks, you had your advisory opinion dealing with mail. So there was never any concept that you couldn't do this. The question is what the percentage was. And we are really advocating going back to a time and space percentage. Why? Because we think it's the most fair. For a number of reasons. But personally, on a presidential level, and I think the commission has to look at this, you can't just lump all candidates together. Certainly on the presidential level, personally, I'm not opposed to setting a minimum floor of 50%. But still time and space, so it could be more than 50%. But when you get to the congressional level, I don't think you can make that judgment call because there are so many variables in there where it could be much less than 40% dealing with one candidate, and particularly if you're going to get involved with multiple candidates. And that's the other point I want to make, that we endorse the idea of hybrid ads can include multiple candidates. And they're the only sense that makes any sense. The only regulation that makes any sense is the time and space. Not so much because of the party contribution to the candidates, but the candidate contributions to each other and being excessive. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Mr. Reeve?
Okay, well, first of all, please don't let Steve off that easy today. I implore you. So.
Oh, we won't.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, thank you for the opportunity to testify today regarding hybrid ads. I'd like to briefly summarize our comments made on behalf of the Democratic National Committee. The DNC generally supports promulgation of a rule permitting hybrid ads. However, the DNC wants to ensure that we are not back here 4 years from now revisiting this issue again amidst new controversies and concerns. Therefore, the DNC supports a rule that provides clear guidance to the regulated community and is easily understood and applied. The DNC's concern is that the failure to provide clear guidance will invite the same types of controversies that surrounded the use of hybrid ads in the 2004 election. The DNC believes that a rule permitting hybrid ads should adhere to two main principles. First, hybrid ads should be permitted not only in connection with one federal office, but multiple federal offices. Second, the Commission should provide guidance to the regulated community as to what types of communications should be considered as hybrid ads. We are aware that other commenters have suggested that the Commission should leave to the regulated community to define what is and what is not a hybrid ad. While the DNC supports maximum flexibility to be provided to the regulated community, the Commission does not take this opportunity to provide that some standard in this instance. Potential confusion and abuse of this rule may require the Commission to refight battles regarding hybrid ads, which I assume is the reason why we are here today. Second, potential abuse of the rule could cause the Commission to revisit whether hybrid ads are even feasible at all. Ultimately, by providing clear guidance to the regulated community, the Commission will ensure long-term success and viability of hybrid ads. With the recent court decision in Wisconsin Right to Life, which may serve to empower outside interests, as well as the recent decrease in party identification by voters, parties now more than ever will desire to identify its candidates with their party and encourage straight ticket voting. Hybrid ads are an essential component to that strategy. Thank you for your time, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Let me see if I can make the machine stop here. Okay, very good. Questions from the commission. Vice Chairman Mason.
Thank you. I'd like to ask all of the panel about our approach to this, and Tom sort of got into it on the multiple candidate question, but really to ask this, what are we trying to protect? And I'd like to suggest or get your response to the proposition that we're not mostly, that there's nothing we're protecting in the movement of money, services, goods from candidates to parties for two reasons. One is that candidates now may transfer unlimited sums to parties for any reason. And so if a candidate for some reason decided to make an ad that somehow represented a contribution to the party, there's no substantive issue that would relate to that. There may be some reporting issue or something like that, but not a substantive problem. So what we are trying to protect is the limit on party-coordinated spending. And I know that there are some people who want to do away with that, and I'd be happy if Congress did away with that, but that's what's in the law now. But what I want to ask or suggest is does that make or shape our regulation writing task? In other words, if we assume that it's not of a lot of importance how much the candidate bears, how much of the cost the candidate bears, what does that do to our thinking about the regulation in terms of a minimum party share, for instance, particularly if we have more than one candidate? Why does it make a difference? In other words, why is the ad less valuable to a party when you mention two candidates or three rather than one?
Well, and I think that's why we support, Commissioner Mason, the idea of having hybrid ads include multiple candidates. We can't make a judgment call whether that makes any political sense in every situation, but it may make sense in some other situations to do that. And that's why I raise the issue. I don't think it becomes an issue between how much the party spends. You've got a coordinated expenditure limit. But I think the concern is that unless you come up with a fair recognition of what the value is, whether the candidate pays for it or not, to that candidate, you could, and if the candidate is reimbursing for its share, which has always been a premise of this commission, you can reimburse for your share of costs, and that's not a contribution or a coordinated expenditure, then the candidates themselves may be making a contribution to another candidate. That's the concern I think you have to deal with if you come up with a straight 50% divided equally among those candidates, or just a one-third, 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 or whatever it is. That may not be the way the ad actually airs, and there may be one candidate that's much more focused on than other candidates, and I think that's the only reason time and space make sense when you have multiple candidates. Looking at how much time each candidate is getting, and that also goes back to the commission's position when you have candidate-to-candidate ads. That has never been an issue, and I believe, you know, 106.1 addresses that in the regulations, and advisory opinions have addressed that. When you have two candidates getting together and doing an ad, you're basing it on the time and space devoted to each one of those candidates.
Would anyone else like to speak on
that? I absolutely agree with Tom. I would acknowledge that in our comments, we support multiple candidate reference. There's really no reason to artificially limit this to one candidate. There could be several compelling reasons why you'd want to have a multi-candidate ad and a generic down ballot reference. And we acknowledge in our comments that there probably is some kind of degradation to the value of the generic reference when you have multi-candidate references. And we do suggest.
Why?
I think we were trying to find a pragmatic rule. I think the more content in a piece, the more you're competing with the attention of the different elements of the ad. I'm more concerned not necessarily with the why, but as to the potential abuse of the rule. So, for example, if you have three candidates and a generic reference, to compartmentalize the entire three candidates into that, say it's a 50% ceiling that you can allocate to generic, I thought that was maybe just a bit too much to chew on. So we suggested a sliding scale based on how many candidates are referenced. Or I shouldn't say candidates. We use the term office because if you attack your opponent and support your own candidate, that shouldn't necessarily count as two elements. That should just be one element. So we believe regulation should use the term office and not candidates. And obviously there's only three federal offices that we're working with here. So it's not, in our opinion, at least an overly complex formula that you would have to create. But the more offices you reference, we just believe the generic reference should have equal weight, I think that's the best way of putting it, to the number of offices referenced.
Mr. Horstein. Mr. Vice Chairman, leaving aside issues of reimbursement or whether it counts against a 441AD limit, let me just simply say that, yes, you should have either under time and space or number of participants, you should have an equal division based on the number of participants, in the case of number of participants. Also, according to time and space, you should have an allocation based on, obviously, the time and space. And there's no reason, in my opinion, that the generic party reference should not be counted or should it be in any way degraded. Because if you think about it, and perhaps Neil's thinking of this, as you have more participants to an ad, there will be a type of degradation as the equal share reduces. That may or may not be what Neil's talking about. But the thing is the generic party reference and the speech of the party needs to be recognized here as well. The parties are not joined at the hip with their candidates, even though they may tell you they are. They have a right under Colorado 1 and recognized in McConnell to speak independently of their candidates. And if they do a generic party reference that the commission can legitimately find a placeholder, evidence of that placeholder in that ad, there's no reason they can't share in the cost of that ad. Now, I suppose if you had an ad that listed every candidate, including governor, and perhaps everyone in the state house or state senate, and a party reference, we could debate that. But I really doubt the commission will ever see that scenario.
Commissioner, just to clarify, when I think in Neil's example of having three candidates in a party, to me there are four participants. And based on time and space, if there's less space devoted to the generic message, that's going to be less that's allocable to the party part of it and more allocable to the candidate part of it. I think that's why we feel very strongly that when you get into a multiple candidate situation with a party message, the only way to deal with that effectively is on a time and space argument rather than, you know, anything that may seem more attractive like a minimum floor of 50% or something that's more fixed.
Okay, very good. Other questions? Maybe I'll jump in. One of the things, I think Commissioner Mason correctly points to one of the things that we're struggling with here is that we are trying to ensure that we continue to enforce 441AD, the coordinated spending limits. And that obviously is the hard part. And one of the things that I had asked, that I want to ask of everybody, is what evidence there is that the down-ticket candidates actually benefit from these ads. And I want to highlight a distinction from Mr. Horstein, who's mentioned a number of times in his comments that we shouldn't look to this question, that in fact the parties are making foolish decisions and our regulation should not get in the way of that. And I agree with that sentiment. But it's more complex for me in part because I think the party has multiple goals. It has both the goal of electing its down-ticket candidates, but it also has the goal of electing the candidate who's specifically identified in the ad. And we need to parse through which of those goals is being achieved. And I think and the regulations are designed, or the rules are designed to try and do that, because we have to comply. We have to enforce the 441AD provisions of the statute as well. Despite that, in your written comments, you did actually point to some specific, evidence in support of that, and Vice Chairman Mason has also cited some anecdotal evidence. But I'd appreciate hearing from the panelists what evidence there is, what leads parties to make these decisions, what is it that prompts them to think that these that there is down-ticket benefit, and this is especially true as the reference to the party becomes vaguer and vaguer in some of these. Mr. Reif, you seem anxious.
I'll just make one, compelling example, which is the 2006 election. I think 2006 showed more than ever, at least from a Democratic perspective, that the party label, I think, has making a major comeback, at least from our side of the aisle. We've had, the ability to tie the Democratic label to candidates transcended what usually happens in congressional elections, where candidates being outspent 4-1 because they were Democrats were able to win what were normally unwinnable elections.
If I can interrupt. So did you change the content of the ads in 06 to try and to reflect that sense? Does the mention of the Democratic
I can't speak
Party
for the DNC because I don't think the DNC itself ran any hybrid ads in 2006. So I can't speak to any empirical evidence myself, and perhaps you might want to ask the congressional campaign lawyers this afternoon if they had run any types of ads like that, because I'm not aware of any personally. And I'm thinking more ahead to the types of branding that we probably or may want to do in 2008. Mm-hmm. I think using the party label and tying them to a strong presidential nominee, for example, will be a very important part of our strategy, especially in very strong Democratic performing areas. I think the loss of party identification, I think we want to make a comeback in that area and try to recapture some Democratic voters who may now vote independent or split their ticket in voting. So I think it will be a very important part of our strategy in 2008.
In response, Mr. Chairman, I don't know of any empirical evidence, but I think it's important to make the point, not only is it happening, but it's the responsibility of a national party committee. We feel it's very strongly, it's our responsibility to support the entire ticket. And particularly in the post-BICRA era, where we don't have the ability to go out and have our old RENSEC accounts where we can use non-federal money to go on do on specific candidates. This is our attempt, using federal dollars to best we can, to deal with an issue that gets down to the grassroots level that says, hey, and go and support the rest of the ticket in the way we did. But, there are going to be issues that are down ticket. There are going to be issues that you're trying to support other federal candidates that are running, your congressional candidates. So that could be federal to federal. But you also have the general statement of what else is going on in that particular state, whether it's a battleground state or not. There are congressional elections. There are state legislative elections. And there are gubernatorial elections in a lot of states next year. And it's a party responsibility to do whatever it can to encourage people to get out and vote for the entire ticket. So I don't think we at the RNC base it on any empirical evidence that we do this because it has an effect. We can put out an ad on a candidate that doesn't have the effect, and quite frankly, it can backfire depending on what the message is. Mm-hmm. The idea is it's our responsibility as a national party organization to do whatever we can to support the entire ticket, and we don't base it on the fact that it's being effective or not, but it's based on a strategy that this is something we're doing and we're required to do because we have a responsibility to do it.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think I'm trying to think of an example as I sit here, and I'm not thinking of one. For that, I apologize. But I think you can easily imagine the DNC or the RNC will always care to elect its president. But I think if you think about it with me, you can imagine a year in which, while the RNC or DNC is doing everything it can to get its president elected, its presidential candidate elected, you may not see any hybrid ads. And the reason is because that candidate is so unpopular or has so botched his campaign that the party committee has made a judgment that tying their other candidates, which they legitimately care about, Neil and Tom have told you that, you won't see any hybrid ads in a cycle like that. And you know more about politics than I do. I'm sure you can imagine that scenario very well, where there wouldn't be any hybrid ads out of an RNC or DNC because their candidate stinks. And that would be their judgment, not protecting their candidate or helping their presidential candidate, protecting their down-ticket candidates. And I believe that while it's a rough analogy, and I wish I had a better example for you, I think it's worth mentioning.
Thank you. Commissioner Weintraub?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that there's not much controversy in saying that the ads ought to be allocated according to the benefit reasonably expected to be derived. The point of this is to figure out what that is. What is the benefit reasonably expected to be derived under various different types of ads? Now, I think that a party might well make the decision that if they have a really strong leader at the top of their ticket, that there will be a coattails effect and that will help all of their down-ticket candidates. But would any of you think that the party could then say, we want to pay for half of an ad that just talks about the great qualities of the leader at the top of the ticket and says, vote for John Doe for president, makes no reference to any other candidate, office, party committee, code word, it's all about John Doe. Now, even if you believe that having John Doe being really popular is going to help your other candidates, I assume that none of you, or tell me if you disagree, would say that the party still should be able to pay for part of that ad without it counting against their coordinated spending limit. Am I correct on that much?
Yes, I agree with that.
Totally.
You're laughing, but it seems to me that when people start making the argument that, well, the party ought to be able to decide what's a benefit to it and what's not, the party could make that You know, that's the logical conclusion of the argument, that if they think that's a benefit to them, they ought to be able to pay for it. See, Mr. Hursting wants to take that on.
No, what I want to say actually is that under First Amendment, let's say circa 1800, that might be an argument. But we do have 441AD limits now, and the commission has to protect those. No, I'm not telling you that. I'm saying that for the purposes of the record. We have 441AD limits now. They've been enforced. My point is to you is what should the commission do now to respect the First Amendment rights of the parties? And my suggestion to you is in order to determine benefit reasonably to be derived.
Reasonably expected to be derived.
Thank you. You should look at objective criteria and say, is this the party's message or not? Not do I think it really helps them or not, or is it a wise use of their cash, or are they stupid, or are they really trying to fool me, or are they winking at me because they know it's not that deft a use? If the commission can objectively say that is their message, then you shouldn't be second-guessing whether it's really going to benefit the party or not. Shouldn't be doing that.
If your point is that we shouldn't try and determine your intent in paying for the ad, I think Chief Justice Roberts, among others, would probably agree with you on that.
Okay.
And that's fine. But it still doesn't answer the question of what is the reasonably expected benefit. Now, suppose you have an ad that says it's almost the same as the last one, all about John Doe and what a great guy he is, and the tagline is now, vote for John Doe and the great Paisley Party team. Okay? Would you argue that the party should be able to pay for 50% of that ad?
Well, again, one of the problems that you face with an example like that, that is not the ad. I think when you look at an ad, you have visuals, you have audio, you have text, and you put it all together and you look at how much is given to a candidate, how much is given to
the team. I'm saying it's all about the candidate.
If it's all about that, then I think that's why time and space is important. There may be a very small part of that that's allowed to be treated as a generic message, but you look at time and space and you say, okay, is this mostly about a presidential and the presidential has to pay more? That's the way the commission, in my mind, for years took look at these kinds of situations that, and you've got an understanding, and this goes back to, I think, what the chairman said. The coattail provisions in the statute recognize there was some benefit by one candidate, but you always had to mention another candidate so that the other candidate mentioned was getting a coattail benefit from that, and that wouldn't be viewed as a contribution in certain circumstances.
But does the other candidate have to be identifiable in some way?
Candidate to candidate, but what we're talking about now is a candidate and a generic message from the party as two distinct identifiable things. And I think instead of getting involved in trying to subjectively decide what categorizes something as allowed and disallowed, the commission's much better off of coming in with a strict definition of what a hybrid ad is. A hybrid ad is an ad that refers to at least one specific candidate and generically to others. And that should be where the commission comes down and leave up to the parties to decide what it means. And if someone disagrees with that, there is the enforcement process. But for you to sit there and try to decide on a case-by-case basis and put out a criteria as to what is and what is not going to fall under allowable activity, I think is a big mistake.
I think what you're suggesting is that we come up with a vague rule and then let you guys file complaints about it and find out 2 years later when we resolve the enforcement matters. And I can't believe that's really what you want.
Not a vague rule, because a hybrid ad by its very nature describes what it is. It's a clearly identified candidate and a reference to the party, other candidates, or generically to how they want to describe themselves.
But again, then we get into the question of what constitutes a generic reference. Would you define Mitch McConnell as a leader in Congress, Mr. Giuseppe?
I would.
And John Boehner?
I would.
I would too, but they're in the minority. And yet the hybrid ads that were run in the last election made references to the president and leaders in Congress, and
but
that was perceived as a generic reference.
We're going to the future, but even there, I would respectfully say you've got to look at the entire ad. Not only the text of the ad, but the visuals and the audio and the pictures and who was on there. And in my mind, what happened in 2004 on the Democratic side was a clear message to me what they meant, And I would respectfully say what happened on our side from their perspective, they understood what we were talking about. We were talking about the Democrats in Congress. They were talking about the Republicans in Congress. And we're satisfied with that. I don't think there's any reason to go backwards. I think what we're doing now is going forward and trying to decide how we're going to deal with this issue. And I'm comfortable with what the regs say now, but I'm also willing to say that for the rest of the regulated community, if the commission is going to take different views, the commission owes it to the regulated community to tell the regulated community what those views are.
I agree with you, and that's what we're trying to do, because the reality is, Mr. Josefiak, that what you were perfectly comfortable with, both in 2000 and in 2004, I was not.
Right, but that's why I think a regulation is important, but I believe, and respectfully would say that, from my experience on the commission, that's why I talked about the history, there was a built-in process, not only from the beginnings of the statute, but from the beginnings of this commission as to what was legitimately considered a party allocable expenditure, and that was a mere extension of what the commission had already done in the past.
Yeah. And I think that this is obviously a struggle, and I've indicated, I think with my questions, Mr. Horstring, that we're struggling with the choice between, you know, I think that there is no doubt that this commission will attempt to be extremely clear about what we're concluding, and yet there is that struggle between, you know, the clarity and freedom and ambiguity and the regulatory regime, and so we're obviously wrestling with those things. And one of the things I think that makes the assessment of whether these ads, whether the party is seeking the goal of electing the person at the top of the ticket, or influencing the races down ticket, in part derives out of some of the examples that we looked at in some earlier cases, which are now on the public record. Where you looked at messages about leaders in Congress running in districts where there were no leaders in Congress in the down ticket side, where the ads were being run in districts where there was no competitive race down ticket at the federal level, and trying to discern whether in fact the party's funding of a hybrid ads in those contexts was really for the purpose of the down ticket races, or was for the purpose of electing the person at the top of the ticket. And so there was disagreement as to what the answer to that question was, but certainly, in looking at the reality of how those ads were cut, the content of the ads, and the actual realities in the districts that were down ticket, it was I think reasonable to discern that the goal in some cases was to inure a benefit to the person who was at the top of the ticket, the clearly identified candidate. And so I think that we just are trying to ensure that whatever rule we come up with really in general application going forward will ensure that the party is able to spend money to benefit down ticket candidates in the way that it wants to, but that it's not a means by which to get around the restrictions of 441 AD. And so I guess with that in mind, I mean, do any of you have any comments about the issue or the struggle that I think one can reasonably go through in looking at hybrid ads that have run in the past and trying to discern whether there really was indications, given the way those races were structured or where the down ticket ballots were running, that they're really what the parties were really seeking in those cases, to influence down ticket races as opposed to simply trying to increase the benefit available to the clearly identified candidate in the ad. Mr. Reed.
Go ahead, Steve.
Well, I'll say one quick thing and then defer it to Neil. There is always the problem of media markets, and they don't neatly divide amongst congressional districts. And I'm sure you're aware of that, but I did want to point that up. Neil?
No, I would say this. As a Democratic Party strategy, and Tom can speak for the Republicans, generic advertising has always been a core and very important element of our strategies, especially in minority areas, what we call our base vote. Generic advertising is kind of the advertising of choice, especially in targeted radio and things like that. So the ability to tie a very strong nominee or strong federal candidates to a generic message, I think, would be a very, very huge benefit to the Democratic Party. And I think we would, we'd want to use it extensively. And I think that be able to make that connection will very much enhance our message and our ability to get out Democrats.
Okay. Other question? Commissioner Montz-Pikoski.
Mr. Rafe, if I could follow up on that, let me ask you a question. I think you said before you were particularly believe that the party label and branding was very important in the last election and maybe in the next. That seems a little bit at odds with the written comments, because I think the written comments for the DNC, it said that the allocation would be, quote, based on a reasonable estimate of time or space devoted to the candidate and to the generic party reference, but with a minimum 50% allocable to the candidate. Why do you, I mean, given what you say about the importance of the party branding, I mean, why do you think there ought to be a 50% minimum going to the candidate? I mean, if you have an ad where, you know, on a time and space, you know, 10% is the candidate, and all the rest of it is really, you know, generic party trying to do that kind of labeling, why put in a 50% minimum?
Well, I think, frankly, we were forgetting about the politics and the strategy aside of why communications are important. I'll just come back to, and I think this comes back to my opening statement, I think the Democratic National Committee really wants and believes that a rule regarding hybrid ads is important. And I think our comments is more an effort to be pragmatic and to find a rule that hopefully more than three commissioners will agree that should be passed. And I think we start with the baseline, and I think the 50%, of course, derives from advisory opinion 2006-11. And that seemed, I didn't really hear many complaints from my side, you know, from the regulated community about that advisory opinion and whether or not that was unreasonable. And I think the commission has countervailing concerns that they had to balance in that advisory opinion, and we believe the commission reached a good balance. And I'm more interested in making sure a viable rule gets passed than worrying about what percentages we base at the minimum. So I think Joe and I were being more predictive about what we think is pragmatic and viable and to ensure that a rule does get passed.
I thought that sort of pragmatism was the domain of only those who worked here. Commissioner Volz-Bukowski.
Follow up with one question. Then I think
and I'm sure I'll get lambasted by my colleagues on that very comment, but what else? I already have, actually.
Welcome to our world.
There seems to be a lot of agreement here between the two parties. Nice show of bipartisanship. But one of the areas that I saw that there was disagreement on is how generic the generic party reference should be.
Right.
And you know, the DNC is suggesting that there has to be a specific reference to the party affiliation. So I'm assuming that means there would have to be a reference to the Democratic Party and not some other general term or moniker. I mean, I know Mr. Hursting has said the opposite. You should leave it up to the party to decide.
You know, I guess you don't necessarily, and again, this permutations of this will be seen over the next several election cycles if a rule is passed. But we didn't believe it was unreasonable, and I share Commissioner Weintraub's concerns in this area, to at least have some minimal reference to a political party, whether it be a nickname or the actual reference. You can just say perhaps a clearly identified political party as opposed to saying the Democratic or Republican or other party. And perhaps someone will come up and perhaps a nickname will appear in the next cycle for a political party that is becomes popular. So you don't necessarily have to mandate the name of the party, but maybe possibly borrowing from your regulation on generic, which is 100.25, where it just says a reference to a clearly identified political party. We don't believe that to be unreasonable, and you know, we shared Commissioner Weintraub's concerns about, you know, pushing the envelope and possibly having the rule eat itself down the line.
I think, Commissioner, if I may, I think perhaps what you should consider is crafting a rule not unlike what Tom mentioned 4 or 5 minutes ago, a hybrid ad is. And then listing several examples, perhaps in the ENJ, and leaving open, but not foreclosing other possibilities, and leave it to more aggressive committees to fare how they will in the enforcement context. I can easily imagine, I can imagine one day someone saying the Paisley Party believes this and the Paisley Party would do that and the Paisley Party, and at that point they would run an ad about the Paisley Party. It wouldn't be one of the examples in your E&J. They'd come before the commission and they'd take their chances. But what the beauty of that is you have not foreclosed the possibility by restrictive examples of the committee ever running an ad about the Paisley Party. You hold open that possibility and they take their chances.
I'd like to know which one of us he considers the Paisley Party, which nickname. But obviously you know what my position is, that you look at, I think you have to look at the context of an ad, not just the text, and from the ad itself. In my humble opinion, it's obvious what party you are supporting or opposing, and you don't need the magic buzzwords, and it should be left up to the individual parties to decide how they want to describe themselves and the opposition.
Well, if I could, I in my written, I'm sorry, Vice Chairman, oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner Walther, please.
Being somewhat new to this process, I wanted to mention one of the factors that was important to me when we had our debate on this issue on audits, and that was my belief that the people who spend the kind of money that's spent on these really know where it's supposed to get the most benefit. And I think that that's a given. They understand what they want, and they spend the money the way they best think they're going to get what they want, and it's typically votes or maybe other types of benefits as well. But when I looked at the figures, that it became a concern to me when we were faced with an argument of a 50-50 split, when we looked at the way the money was spent, because roughly, and I think the percentage may be off one or two, but not by very much, the Republican Party spent roughly 85% of their money, their hybrid ad money, in the battleground states, and the Democrats spend approximately 92% of their money in the battleground states, which led me to believe that they must have thought the reason why that money was best spent was to sway votes for the presidential ticket. And I grant you that we shouldn't be sitting here trying to figure out factor by factor what's the best percentage, and that's not really where we have the expertise. But to look at what the benefit reasonably expected to be derived was, I feel that when that kind of money is being spent and the way it was spent really swayed me into thinking that that kind of an allocation wasn't going to really be persuasive to me. Even in Michigan, where there wasn't a senatorial candidate, quite a bit of money was spent. I think only one candidate spent like $150,000 on TV ads, and over $2 million was spent supporting, you know, which was allocated to the other party. So in that regard, it just seemed to me that it was important to me to get a better understanding of why people would spend that kind of money if they really thought it was 50-50 split was benefited here. So I'd welcome thoughts from any of you. That
well, I'll make 2 points. The methodology that we're putting out there is, well, first of all, is a time and space with a ceiling. So you couldn't necessarily abuse or floor ceiling. It depends on which side you look at it. What you're really looking at there is the content of the ad. It's really difficult, I think, for the commission and even us as lawyers to try to import a strategic element here and try to regulate strategy and regulate targeting. I mean, for example, even 527s, if you look at 527 advertising and nonprofit advertising, you'll find that the overwhelming majority of that was in those same exact states. Yet there really isn't much you can do from a regulatory perspective to police the targeting of the ad. So I understand the concern, but I think from a legal perspective, it's difficult to address that question.
I'll take another run at this if I can. It won't be an emphatic run, but here we go. I think Commissioner Walther, what you may be looking at is the benefit to be derived from the point of view of a hearer, and that is not a determination the FEC really wants to be involved in. And I think you sense that because I've heard some of your earlier statements to that effect, that you really don't want to be involved in the picking of the percentages necessarily based on your impression of how effective something will be. So in order to enforce the 441AD limit, which you are obliged to do, you're absolutely right about that, you need to look to object. You need to look at the text of an ad and say, listen, this is the party committees. I don't know if it's gonna persuade somebody in Wyoming a lot or persuade them not much, but I do know it's theirs. I can tell that if something says President Bush and our leaders in Congress believe X, and the X is all attributed to both of them, then I can do 50-50. If I have an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, and 3/4 of it is a picture of Bush, and 1/4 of it says Republicans are great, that's 75%. At no point in time, though, in both my examples, are you saying, you know what, those guys in Wyoming look at the bottom of the paper, and I know that they're going to get a heck of a lot more than 25% benefit out of that. Bush should only have to pay 65%, and the party be getting off easy if we let him pay 25%. That's not the business you want to be in, and I think you agree with that. So that's what I keep trying to get at when I say objective, which is some criteria based on the ad versus benefit to be derived in the mind of the hearer. That's what I'm trying to get at. I'm not saying it particularly well, but that's what I'm trying to get at.
I think Steve is saying it very well. I think the idea is that, again, subjectivity, you could look at the same thing and come up with, oh, I think that goes 100% one way or 100% the other way. The objective criteria has been time and space and or the 50%, depending on if it's phone bank or the mail, and I think that's where the objectivity standard comes in, not necessarily what actually practically happens, but the objectivity standard. You've got a message. How can you best decide how that message should be divided? And I think he said it very well.
Yeah, good. Ms. Duncan?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
All of you, it seems, to a certain degree, have indicated a preference for a time-space component of the attribution and of the attribution method. And it seems to me, though, that some in the regulated community historically have somewhat disagreed with that view, because they've indicated that that's sometimes a difficult calculation to apply. Perhaps it's been characterized today as objective, but I've heard it characterized before as subjective. And I wonder if you might address what you believe may be some challenges, if you believe there are any, in the actual practical application of that calculation, particularly in the context of television ads, where you have audio and visual components. Thanks.
Well, let me make a general comment about time and space, and I'll see what I can do on specifics. I've been an attorney for state parties for many, many years, and they're probably the one entity that most has to use time and space analysis, because we're doing, especially before BCRA, we had to do time and space based on the FEC regulations. It's not so much now because, for example, exempt activities are now on a split. But prior to BCRA, we were doing time and space on a daily basis during the campaign, and we, especially with respect to printed material and telephone scripts and radio scripts, we got pretty good at doing it. And we would use, we'd pull out our rulers. Everyone had a pretty reasonable method. I can't say there was a unified method, but everyone had at least a reasonable method to do it. And I understand the commission always looks at reasonableness, and if it is reasonable, they will not try to interject their own methodology. TV gets much more difficult, and I'll be honest with you, I haven't had that many opportunities to do time and space in a TV context as I have in printed and other mediums. So it will be a challenge. I can't say I have a magic answer on how to do it, because I really haven't tried to do it or thought of a formula, but I think we can figure something out, and I think it will be reasonable, and hopefully the commission will agree.
I think you're raising a very legitimate point. Time and space is a challenge. I think that having been around long enough, it has been a position of the commission, as Neil said, for lots of reasons, particularly for state parties over the years, to how you allocate costs. But having gone through the experience of actually having to do television ads on time and space, it is challenging because you're looking at every word in the text, every picture by frame. You're looking at what is being said versus what is on the screen. And so that it is a challenge to ensure that if you're coming up with a 50-50 standard or time and space standard, that you feel comfortable enough that based on your analysis, because that's where it all comes down, based on your analysis, you're making that point. But I think even though it's challenging, it's the fairest approach to take, because you cannot, in my mind, come up with a one-size-fits-all rule about, a 50-50 or whatever, because what may be true in a presidential context may not be true in a Senate context or a congressional context when you're at that level. And I think you've got to leave enough flexibility to have at least the opportunity to invoke a time and space allocation. But it is a challenge, there's no question.
I would simply echo what they've said and also say this. I realize it is difficult to apply in television, particularly because of the 2 cents issue that Chairman Lenhardt raised in his posted questions on the web. But I always, whenever I think about whether we should retain time and space, I always think about the phone bank poll that would say, John McCain's great. John McCain's a war hero. John McCain would protect us nationally. John McCain's good on taxes. John McCain's good on Social Security. Oh, by the way, elect Dinglethorpe and Shaw. you really want to have time and space available, I think, for the commission, I would think, in enforcing allocation regulations for a phone bank just like that one. So while I agree there's a difficulty in television, I always think of that phone bank thing, that call to someone on election day, and I think, you know, you can split that 50-50 or 25-25-25. Anyway.
But one other point is to try to relive history here. You know, there is technology now where you can put this on your own computer screen and second by second, frame by frame, go through it and feel fairly comfortable that you are allocating this in a manner that is based on time and space.
Thank you.
Good. Vice Chairman Mason.
I just want to follow up on that. And first, I want to go back to this enforcement premise and say that I personally am highly dissatisfied by that. When, you know, any agency that enforces regulations sometimes ends up in the enforcement process in trying to determine the fine points. None of you gentlemen want your clients, or Mr. Hursting may not have clients, at least with the hat he's got on, who are likely to be here. But the other two don't want your clients, your parties, your candidates in the enforcement process. And the first thing I can tell you, the first thing you'll tell us is, oh, you didn't say that. It's not fair in the enforcement process to come along and issue an interpretation that wasn't out there before. And so the commission, and there's six of us, and there are party divisions, and there are philosophical divisions, and it becomes very hard. And when I'm in the enforcement process, what I'm looking for is, where's the ruler? Where's the ruler? And if the only thing is reasonability, there isn't one. I'm not comfortable sitting here and making, you know, some kind of you know, jury-style tort, you know, reasonability analysis to go back in and then make a $40 million repayment analysis. And that's why we're here. And I know Commissioner Weintraub was frustrated by that answer. I want to express that as well. And if it really is the unified position of the party that the enforcement process is the way to work these things out and that we should make repayment determinations and assess fines because you, in good faith, made a determination and the commission 6 months or a year or 2 years later made a different reasonableness interpretation, then fine, let's get that out and go down that road. But I don't think you want to be there either. So I think what you're suggesting is, well, give us leeway. I don't disagree with that. I think a regulation ought to be flexible. But if there's a suggestion that the enforcement process is a good way to flesh out the contours of that regulation, I just reject it. And I want to go back to the video thing because I understand you could sit there, and you know, my first experience was back to the 96 campaigns, and then Commissioner Thomas, in very good faith, wanted to queue up the ads and have the commission watch the ads and make a determination. And I was not satisfied there because we couldn't answer before we watched the ads, what were we looking for? And I didn't want to be in a position of just sort of looking at the ads and deciding, well, were these really party ads, were these candidate ads? It was a different set of legal issues, but it was the same ultimate question. And we could reach very different judgments in looking frame by frame about, for instance, what a picture of the Capitol meant. And it was, and the problem I have is Mr. Hursting's problem there. You know, how are we supposed to judge what, you know, whether a picture of the Capitol, because Congress meets in the Capitol, goes to House and Senate candidates, or does it go to something else? And when you start matching up the video, the audio, and the text, then I think you end up with a very mushy sort of regulation. Now, I'm not uncomfortable giving parties and candidates in that context a significant amount of leeway, but I want some kind of bound or some kind of criteria out there, which is why, for instance, a minimum percentage is very appealing because then it puts some sort of bound out there, some ultimate bound on, well, how far can you go? And if we disagree with the judgment, where can you take it? But let me just get back to this. Do you really want to have a situation where, in order to defend your time and space analysis, you have to have some kind of memo of, okay, here's what we did. we sat down and went through frame by frame, and here's how we allocated it this way, and then have the commission second-guessing that. Is that what you want?
Well, I guess I'd be curious why the commission would even second-guess it. I guess that's where I would start off with it.
Because we have a regulation that says reasonable, and we're enforcing the regulation, and we have an obligation to determine whether that was reasonable or not. And if we have no description of how the decision was reached, then how do we know if it's reasonable?
You're looking at the ad and making a decision whether it's reasonable. But my that's my point. I said when I first opened in my opening remarks, I said I don't think you need a regulation to allow this to occur. However, in my personal opinion, because everyone doesn't live with inside the Beltway and everyone isn't going to spend the time that we have to spend going through ad by ad, that they need some direction. And so that I understand that needs to happen. Having said that, the question is, where do you draw the line? And my view is that you leave as much flexibility with the party committees to make that decision, how they're going to identify themselves, and what is and what is not, in their view, the generic message. And that's where I said if someone has a problem with that, then you have the enforcement mechanism. But I certainly think there has to be a sort of a blueprint as to what is sort of an acceptable proposition. I feel very comfortable that both parties followed that in the past and will continue to follow that. Sure. But, you know, obviously people on the agency don't feel that way, and that's what's sort of baffling to me, quite frankly, on the history of where this agency has been in the past. So, you know, any guidance that you give, and I think it's going to be important for the future, that if you are going to take a different view, it needs to be spelled out so that the community doesn't fall within the parameters of the enforcement process.
I agree with Tom. I don't believe that the concept of time and space is a new concept, a foreign concept to us. And I think both Tom and I, and I hope I speak for other party lawyers, are very comfortable with the idea. Now, obviously, TV creates a new challenge to us, but I don't feel like our clients or Tom or I can come up with a methodology that we believe the commission will find reasonable. And I'm comfortable that we can accomplish that. And I think it will stand the test of a possible enforcement action. So I don't think that is our biggest concern. Again, echoing Tom, anything to do make this as simple and reasonable as possible is fine. But I'm not worried about time and space.
Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Tom, let me ask you a question about a comment that our former Commissioner Sandstrom, his client, Mark Brewer, who's the president of the Association of State Democratic Chairs, put in, and his comment was, he says, the allocation rule for phone bank should not be different from the rule for direct mail or for a broadcast communication, because he says different allocation requirements would regularly lead to unwitting violations of the law. And I think he's particularly talking about local and state parties who are not as up to date. Now, you know, we've heard some comments and some arguments that, well, the rules should be different for different kinds of media. They have different effects, so forth. I mean, what do you all think about that particular comment?
I think the commission can craft a rule that can be a unified rule for all types of public communications. And then, of course, the nature of each communication will take care of itself because, for example, if you're doing a GOTV phone bank and you're only getting on and off the phone in 10 seconds and you're saying vote for Smith and the rest of a Democratic ticket, by its own nature, it will be more likely to be a 50-50 split. If you're doing a mail piece and you're devoting more time to the candidate-specific communication, by its own nature, it will be a higher candidate percentage to the application. So I think the commission can craft a rule that is flexible for different types of communications. So I don't have a problem with there being one unified regulation for all public communications.
And Commissioner, I agree with that. Our comments actually reflect that the 106.8 should be amended to reflect that and that it applies to everything and in one place. And Neil is right. It was easy and quite frankly practical when the commission developed the rule on phones, because usually a phone is a very short message, and it made sense that for all practical purposes it would be somewhere in the range of a 50-50. The mail advisory opinion obviously is a little more challenging because the rhetoric is longer, and mail can be from one page to 50 pages depending on what the message is. So, and TV creates its own little challenges, and radio does as well. But, you know, again, going back to the time and space analogy, that it all sort of works out. But, you know, I think, you know, we've had experiences with the phones. We've had experiences with the mail based on the advisory opinion. We've had the experience with TV and radio now based on the 2004 cycle. And I think the commission, quite frankly, could look at all of that in the context of developing a single rule that would be fair across the board. So there wouldn't have to be multiple layers.
And I'll say this. The commission wrote a rule for phone banks, and I think it was based on, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, a very simplistic assumption that phone banks were a very quick in-and-out message. You get on the phone, you say vote for and the ticket, and you're out. And I think the regulation was based upon that simplistic assumption. Then 2 years later, you had the opportunity to readdress the same exact issue with mail. And you could have gone the route of saying, okay, we'll just, by analogy, take the phone bank reg and apply it to the mail. But the commission, I believe, recognized that mail was a different animal than this phone bank regulation and crafted a more flexible rule. So it's clear that the commission can craft a rule that covers different types of medium.
Okay. Commissioner Walther.
One of the I think there is a special problem with when you have different mediums and you have a telephone conversation where there could be back and forth on the conversation. We have a mailer, which is really you're talking about basically space, if you want to look at it that way, unless you want to look at factors beyond that. But when you get to the television, I doubt any of you may remember this in person, but I certainly do in 1964 when they had that one ad. I don't remember if they even had any visual, any audio or not, but it was about the little girl picking the petal off the flower and the mushroom cloud behind her, and it, some would argue that sunk a presidential campaign. And then how do we measure that? So I think we don't really feel like we want to get in the business of doing that and measure the impact of a visual message. So I think we, you know, we're striving for a bright line rule of some kind. If that's so, and if most of the money, like 80% to 90% of the money, is really spent on hybrid ads for the presidential election, you know, intuitively it tells me that that's really the president has the biggest benefit to be derived. How would you feel about a higher percentage based upon the office here, say president as opposed to senator candidate, with some flexibility above that, so a minimum of X and for one office for the president, but why for Congress or Senate?
I think I would. I'm not either of the party committees. I'm sure you know that, but used to be. What I would say to that, frankly, is I would not prefer that approach. And I think the way to look at the other side of the coin of what you said, Commissioner, is it is the judgment of the National Party Committee that by tying with the presidential candidate, they most benefit their down ticket candidates. That's what they're really doing. I mean, one could fairly say that. As fairly as you said the other, I could fairly say the reason they're tying to Bush is because that's how they get the senators and House members elected. Until 06, then they wouldn't do anything with Bush because it killed them to be affiliated with Bush. But you see my point. It's not that they run hybrid ads just to elect the president. They run at the top of the ticket because those generic references help everybody down ticket. And I don't think the commission has any evidence for saying otherwise, frankly. And the method of going by the number of participants or time and space has the benefit of keeping those decisions within the party committees, the speakers.
There is a little bit of evidence to that respect, and I'd want to get spend a little more time on it. But if you look at some of the way the money was spent, say in Michigan, Minnesota, and New Mexico, they spent a total of $20 million on hybrid TV ads, where the candidates themselves only spent a minuscule amount. I can't remember, like something, I think it was $407,000 on TV ads. I mean, it does tell me that in those particular cases, the candidates certainly would have spent a lot more money if that was the true measure of what the impact was going to be. But some of those races were not even close. So if you look at it from that perspective, that doesn't always bear out because a lot of times the money is spent where there's, like in Michigan, for example, I think there were 15 congressional candidates and only one had a close race.
Well, I'll just say that I don't think the commission should be in a position to write a regulation based upon impact. I think the commission has to take a fact pattern that's put before it, in a particular ad, and they have to make a judgment based upon a particular communication. And I think it would be a dangerous precedent for the commission to start saying that one type of federal office has more value than another federal office. And I don't believe there's anywhere else in the federal law regulations where such a value judgment is made, other than to say that there are obviously better limits for different races. But in terms of the commission writing allocation regulations, I think that wouldn't be a good precedent to do.
The other thing, Commissioner, just you gave the impression that the candidates didn't spend any money in those states. You mentioned the $20 million that was spent, when theoretically they spent 10, because it was still their money, but they decided they were going to coordinate with the party with a generic message as opposed to just doing 100% candidate spot. So the other 400 and whatever thousand they were spending in that state was 100% candidate spot, because they decided they wanted to be left alone and not be tied to anybody else. So it's not like they didn't spend the money. They spent it in cooperation and coordination with the party. And I think that's an important point to make. It's
not
that
benefit.
It wasn't spent.
Thanks. Okay. Thank you.
Maybe I'll, if I want to, I guess, go back, I think, to a point that the vice chairman was wrestling with, which is, what do we, to the degree that we you know, that you're seeking a standard, or that we're looking at considering a standard that is very flexible or ambiguous, you know, how that relates to the enforcement process. And I'd given a hypothetical in, I guess, my questions to Mr. Josifiak, of an ad, because I guess, and this goes more to the point, but that I think both Mr. Josifiak and Mr. Horstring raised, which is that parties should be free to name, create their own nicknames. And my question is, well, does that unfortunately, as we're wrestling through this, includes making up the nicknames of your opponents. And the example I drafted was, candidate X has stood shoulder to shoulder with those who are soft on terrorism. In vote after vote, she's refused to give our troops the support they need. And my sense from the colloquy here is that you're comfortable with a world where, whether the Democratic Party is, you know, the soft on terrorism party is a nickname for the Democratic Party, is one that's best left to the enforcement action. If people want to take their chances with that, you know, so be it. But I'm not sure that's really what you were saying. But that's often the practical world we find ourselves in, and I think the source of some of his frustration, certainly some of mine. But
I think obviously you're looking for objective evidence of a party placeholder. At least that's the way I say it. I'm not quite sure how you'd say it, Chairman Leonard. You're looking for objective evidence of a party placeholder, and you're wondering, is those soft on terrorism sufficient? It may not be sufficient. But another thing I do want to point up, and it's a related point, I think it's important, though. If you look at your hypothetical and your question, it says, candidate X has stood shoulder to shoulder with those who are soft on terrorism. In vote after vote, candidate X has refused. But it says nothing about what those who are, quote, soft on terrorism have done or have not done, what they believe or do not believe, votes they have cast or have not cast. Whereas if you look at every ad in the 04 cycle, it says Bush and our leaders in Congress have a plan. John Kerry and the liberals in Congress side. Both of them are taking these actions, hold these beliefs, have cast these votes. That's absent in your hypothetical. You don't have anybody who's, quote, soft on terrorism doing anything, believing anything, espousing policies, casting votes. And I think that's a very important point. I'm not sure quite how to think about it. It struck me last night when you posed these questions. I'm not sure how the commission works this in, or whether you should or not. But there is a weakness in your hypothetical in terms of genuinely holding a place for the party committee, because you don't have the soft on terrorism people doing anything, believing anything, or casting any votes. And therefore, we wonder whether they really are a true organization, which context would bear out, by the way. We wonder whether they really are a true organization, which is the very thing you're pointing up. You're saying, Steve, how can these be a real organization? It just says soft on terrorism. And I'm saying back to you, Chairman Lenhardt, if you had them voting, if you had them believing something, if you had them with a plan, if you had them siding with trial lawyers, if you had them believing in tax relief, if you had them, et cetera, perhaps you would be okay with soft on terrorism as a moniker for the opponents. I don't know that. You might not be. What I think you should do is, I think you should, if you're going to craft a rule, you should put a bunch of examples of what you believe to be adequate party placeholders, or what some people might call a generic party reference. And if someone wants to run an ad that doesn't fit within that, then they have to go to the enforcement process. That leaves open their ability to actually speak, to use the word soft on terrorism. Two things. I don't think you're going to actually see that ad. I don't think you are. And the other thing is, you've already accommodated for the possibility they're going to be in trouble in the enforcement process, yet you've allowed them to exercise their First Amendment rights. Sorry for the long answer.
No, it's no. The long answer is the length of the answer. I think is fine. I guess what I'm struggling with. I mean, I think that saying someone's soft on terrorism is identifying or casting them or giving them a position on a policy issue that they're that is pejorative but real. But I guess the more fundamental question is: do you believe that generic party references or a reference to a group is only qualifies as a generic party reference to the degree that you ascribe a policy position to them? And characterize whether that's a good or bad policy position.
What I'm saying is that in each of the ads you're dealing with, you always see the other organization, be it liberals in Congress. Some people are saying, listen, you either have to have Republicans in Congress or you have to have Democrats in Congress or it's not a generic party reference. Because otherwise, you can't expect the voters to vote against their opponents, let's say, for liberals in Congress. But in your scenario, you have candidate X doing a lot of things. You have candidate X standing shoulder to shoulder with people, but you don't have the soft on terrorism people voting. You don't have them believing anything. And I'm just saying it would be rare that you would ever see a hybrid ad that looks like that. And perhaps Tom and Neil will either jump in and disagree with me vehemently, or they'll say, yeah, you would never see a hybrid ad like that. You just wouldn't see one like that.
Gentlemen, an opportunity
Chairman,
to jump in.
I struggle with your example because, first of all, I wouldn't do it, and I wouldn't let that go as being what I would consider a hybrid ad because there is, but I think the mistake again that people are making is they're taking a line out of context and it's a script versus looking at an ad that again has the visuals of liberals in Congress with Ted Kennedy and a bunch of other people that people already recognize as leaders of the Democratic Party. It was clear in my mind that we were talking about Democrats. And I don't think Democrats would disagree with that. But at the same time, in an amorphous setting like, you know, she votes with people who are soft on terror, doesn't say where she is or what she's doing or what the exhortation is, vote for whom. And so I think that you've got to look at it in the context of what the ad is and not a line from an ad as to whether or not it meets the standard. And that was what I was struggling with because this, in my mind, doesn't say anything to me that says it's a hybrid ad, but I don't see the rest of the ad to make that determination. But that alone, in my mind, wouldn't qualify because it isn't – it's amorphous.
Okay. Vice Chairman Mason.
I just wanted to hone in on this. Maybe Michael Bloomberg will found a party or affiliate with a party. And Mr. Bloomberg's party could run an ad that says there are two parties in Washington, the evil party and the stupid party.
That's right.
It's time for competence and common sense. Vote Bloomberg.
The difference is,
what happens? Is that
Bloomberg doesn't have to use a party to make that expenditure. That's the difference.
but is that then, does that qualify? I mean, that gets to, you know, nicknames. I mean, you know, the GOP is a pretty common nickname for the Republican Party, and that's pretty easy. I mean, most of the time the Republican Party doesn't use that acronym in its ads, but you could go through and do some market research and all of a sudden conclude, hey, you know what, people like that, and all of a sudden, and that would be easy. But when you get beyond that, it seems to me you need some bound for what constitutes a generic reference. And
but I guess the first question I would have in your example, is he saying vote for against their candidates for president, which is voting, or is it vote against the party leaders in party in Congress? You don't vote for the party, you vote for candidates
but,
of the party.
But no, the question is, does that constitute candidates? A generic party reference? I mean, you know.
Sure it does.
What we can, so you.
The reference is generic, but what the implication is when Bloomberg is putting out an ad, he's talking about the party, is he talking about the presidential candidates of that party, or is he talking about something else that would consider itself to be a generic?
Well, I mean, let's assume that they throw in enough to indicate the whole party and other candidates, that you would say that those names, evil and stupid, are effective generic party references.
Well, if he's only talking about two parties, well, then we'd have to decide which one is.
Yeah,
which.
Well, that's true.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you. I also wanted to follow up
by
on
my opinion.
Part of the exchange. And by the way, Mr. Josefiak, I completely agree with you. Ted Kennedy is definitely a Democrat. I was I think part of the exchange between the chairman and Steve brought up something that I was thinking about when I read your response to the chairman's questions that you had posted on your website. And it seems to me that what you're suggesting is a more content-based investigation, where we would have to go into the content of the ad and say not only who's identified, but what are we saying about them? Are we saying good things about them? Are we saying bad things about them? Are we saying how they vote or what positions they've taken? And that struck me as going sort of in the opposite direction from most of the comments. And I was curious whether Tom and Neil had the same reaction that I did, that maybe we don't want to go down that road.
I certainly would agree.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. That's why I think we need to, I mean, I think our approach, the generic party reference, is, I think, a clear rule. It's easy to understand, and I think it'll be less intrusive.
Okay. Ms. Duncan?
Thank you. This may be a bit of a repetition of the last question, but I think it might be important to ask. And at the risk of simplifying what I think your positions are on generic party references, it seems that Mr. Hursting would look only for objective evidence of a party placeholder for that, and Mr. Josefiak at base would allow the party really to define what the generic party reference is. And it seemed that, Mr. Reif, in your comments, you went further than that and added some more structure to indicate that at least the party nickname would be required. And I just wondered if you would talk a bit more about that. You've answered briefly in response to Commissioner Weintraub's question, but I wonder, would you accept, for example, a generic party reference to identify a political party unambiguously without using the nickname, with something else that might make that reference?
I think the best, again, I said this earlier, I think probably the best approach from a regulatory perspective, and I don't have the regs, and I don't know if you have a regulation book, but probably to echo either the language in the advisory opinion 2006-11, although that doesn't give a lot of specific guidance, but I think 100.25, for example, the definition of generic, I think is a relatively easy term to understand. I believe it says reference or promotes or attack. I mean, you can decide whether you want to make it a reference test or a promoter, supporter, attack, or oppose type of test. But then it says a clearly identified political party without, I hope I'm getting this right, clearly identified political party without reference to any candidates. And you can say, you know, craft a regulation that says that portion of the ad, then tracking that language would be a good approach.
Thank you. That's helpful.
I still think that even under that approach, you would have to define what you mean by clearly identified.
Sure.
Because it gets into the whole nickname thing again. So, GOP is clearly identified to some. It may not be to others. I think you're just going to have to figure out where you're going to draw that line.
Yeah, the commission should, when I say objective evidence, the commission can't obviously rely entirely on the party committees to tell them where their generic reference is. They have to set a standard. I say give examples, and if a party committee says, hey, we want to go, we believe in the enforcement case, we can convince you that even though you didn't put this in as an example 5-6 years ago, it's valuable now as a legitimate party placeholder, and that's the way I see it.
And the way I see it is it's our responsibility to look at whatever regulation you come up with and make sure that we feel comfortable enough that it fits under that standard without you having to spell it out exactly what that standard is. Mm-hmm. Now, we'll take that responsibility, but we recognize that, you know, you will come up with a standard.
Okay. Any other questions? Comments, thoughts? Okay. Ms. Clark, any thoughts from the staff director's office at this point?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Good. Well, gentlemen, I cannot express how much we appreciate you coming and spending time with us on this. It is enormously helpful for us, and I want to thank you for doing that and thank your clients for helping to arrange that. We're going to take a short recess, and we'll reconvene at noon. Thank you.